Fernando Leiva. Agora eu tenho 10 anos e não sei se eu sou na nota do Cosme Vila e Novo, do Estado. We have requested, we have requested this meeting, we have applied, honorable members and the department, it's constituency period, as you know, as you are aware, but because we've got the load, and we thought if we can request for this day to come and actually reduce the workload that we have, it's very important, and it's going to assist us and the department. Our agenda today is the only one. We're going to deliberate on the basic condition of employment. Amendment bill will be 13B of 2013 and of 2012, sorry, 2012. And the labor relation amendment bill B 16B. Did I say, No, 2013, I'm sorry. Amendment bill of 2012. Looking at the B version today. Last week when we were in Pretoria, we looked at the first as the bill was presented. So today we're going to look at the B version. Mr. Mkalib, over to you. And I, my understanding is that you have received all the submissions, and as you will be presenting to us, to assist us also to understand, we would request that for all the submissions, you respond to them one by one, you know, one by one, thoroughly so that we also we'll be able to understand and satisfy ourselves. I don't know how many submissions. I think we have 10, plus minus 10 submissions, but if we can deal with that, there's nine submissions. Over to you, Mr. Mkalib, and welcome. You are part of the family. You don't even need to say welcome because we see each other every week. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, honorable members. The submissions that are made by different parties, the main thrust of the issues that are raised in the submissions is around about the constitutionality of the changes that we are making. It's around about the impact of the changes that we're making on jobs. It's around about the issues around collective bargaining, the changes that we're making around collective bargaining, and the issues around the placing of security when you take cases to the CCMA. It's around the issues around discrimination, equal pay, work, equal value. Now, Chair, what I'm requesting is that we will deal with all the issues, but we're not going to be able to, because of the time that we took in drafting this, we're not going to be able to say this submission says this, but we'll deal with all the issues covered in the submission as I'm putting on the table here. Our submission deals with the issues, but it does not single out and say Anglo-American is saying this, but we'll deal with all the issues that are put in the submission. As I've said, we're going to be responding on those issues. In the last meeting that we held in Pretoria by the committee requested us to take the committee through the changes that were made by the Postal Committee on Labour to the original bill. And that's what the first slide is trying to do. The committee, in its deliberation, decided to delete all the clauses relating to strike, ballot, picketing. In the original bill, it was close 64, 65, 67, and 69. You are not going to have them in this bill because the committee decided to delete those after deliberation. The next area that all of these clauses, are those clauses, I mean, if members could remember, that require trade unions before they go on strike, they must have a ballot. That was the proposal that was put in the bill. And the other one that also linked to this is the issue of what are the consequences of not following the legal processes. It's dealing with that 64, 65, 7, and 69. All of those areas, it's about ballot, about picketing. If workers go out on picket and there's violence, what are the rights of the public and the companies and the workers? That's a section. The committee, as I've said, in their deliberation, took a decision to take those areas, to vote those areas out of the bill. The next area was section 1A of that bill. That section was dealing with what we called, we put a provision that said that people who are doing, exercising authority in the name of the state, example, people like who work in immigration officers, they take decision in the name of the state who should come in the country, who should not be coming in the country. They allow even goods to come into the country and which goods should not come into the country. And they exercise that authority in the name of the state. And the proposal that we made in the bill in Section 71 was that the definition of essential services should be changed. My colleague is telling me that it's in the PEC that has been given, the previous bill as it was.
Sorry, Chair, I believe that the documents handed to members contains the bill as was before the National Assembly. And considering Mr. Khalifi is now pointing out what was taken out of that bill, I just thought that members could follow in the PAC, which is now on page 10, in clause 13, of the bill as introduced, so they could see what that provision looked like, dealing with what he's speaking about at the moment. That's page 10 of the introduced bill, clause 13.
Thank you, Chair. Section 71A, as I was saying, Chair, is that that was that section that says that then those people who are exercising authority in the name of the state, in deciding the definition of essential services, should be changed. Because remember, essential services presently is only those workers that if they go out on strike, it will affect life and limb. People might die and people might get injured. Therefore, those sectors are declared essential. We're introducing another principle that says, well, people working in the immigration, in the border, if they go out on strike, nobody might die, nobody might get injured, but the security of the state might be compromised. And then we're saying that you should be able to go and argue in front of the Essential Service Committee that if you are exercising authority in the name of the state, you should be regarded as essential. That's what it meant. And that area was voted out. Because the reason it was voted out is that it was felt that it interferes with the definition that is accepted of essential services, of life and limb. That you can only restrict the right to strike if it's going to affect life and limb. The next area was the area around labor broking, section 198A of the bill, where we were proposing 6 months. The committee changed that proposal to 3 months. You'll see when we deal clause by clause, it's in page 21 of the PEC. On that, that's the next area. The next area from there is an area on section 198.4 dealing with the issue of the termination of an assignment. For making a mistake, this area was not changed. Yes, it is linked to probation. The next area is fixed term contract dealing with probation. The area around probation, we propose that it should be easy to dismiss workers who are on probation, or you should be able to not dismiss per se, you should be able to employ workers on fixed term contract because they are on probation. If you look at section 198B, it's got the exception in terms of fixed term contract, and one of the exceptions was probation. And the decision was that we should take that section should be deleted from the bill. The next area, as I said, is the 6 months, 3 months. I've dealt with that one. And the next area that was also deleted was the issues around strike action 198A4. And then the next one was 198B. 198B, which deals with the amount of months. We were proposing that if you work on contract, fixed term contract, for more than 24 months, when that contract ends, you should get severance pay, like retrenchment. If you work on a fixed term contract for more than 24 months and that contract ends, you should be able to be paid severance pay. The Portfolio Committee on Labor says no, 24 months is too long. We must link this to the BCA. Because the BCA says now, if you are more than 12 months and you get retrenched, you are entitled to severance pay. And the Portfolio Committee says it should be linked to that because it's talking to severance pay. They move 24 to 12. The next area was the issue around contract employment itself, the fixed term contract. The fixed term contract was linked to labor broking. The bill originally said that you cannot work on a fixed term contract more than 6 months. The committee made that trade to link it to the issues of temporal employment. It reduced 6 to 3. And the last area was part-time employment. The same arrangement happened there where it reduced from 6 to 3 on the part-time employment. Just the slide doesn't say that, but 198CD also clarified part-time employment below the threshold. The original bill talked to 6 months. This bill that is in front of the committee is reduced to 3. Those were the changes, about 2, 4, 6, 8 changes that were made by the committee in their sitting when they voted on this issue. Now, I've finalized the areas that were changed by the committee. I'm going now to the response on the submission that the committee has received. I'm not sure whether should I, if there are any questions, because this is a different area. If there are any questions, this may be, but I'm at your service, Chairperson. Whether should I continue or should I take questions on this or clarification?
Members, do you have any questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Chairperson, the first part you handled about the strikes and the balloting of what about the democratic rights of individuals? I'm asking that question because if a union decided we're going to strike, and we have it now many times in the minds, some people want to strike and other people want to get back to work. How are we going to handle this issue in the bill?
Presently, the law says that if the Constitution of the Union requires a ballot, a ballot is required in terms of the law and the constitution of the union. Therefore, if your constitution, for example, in the clothing and textile sector, their constitution says they, before they go on strike, they ballot. And the law now says that if a union has got a constitutional provision that requires that, they must do that. Therefore, that is still applicable. And that's how you manage it. The only difference is that the law doesn't say that it is a must that your constitution must have that provision. And we're assuming that a trade union is made out of workers. It's workers who will be able to take that decision whether they want that protection in their constitution to go. If workers don't take that decision in their constitution, then it means that they are not looking for that. They don't see this as an issue for them.
Yeah, sorry, Chief, can I just follow up?
We also have a lot of illegal strikes on different areas, mines and the motor industry and every vehicle industry. So what about that? And I think that is the people decided to strike, and then there's a lot of people who say no, but they're not going to strike, and it's an illegal strike. How are they protected? How in the bill? Is there any way they are protected in the bill or not? I'm talking about now illegal strikes.
In terms of the law, members, is that workers going first? In terms of the law, there's no such a term as illegal strike, because remember, all strikes are protected by the constitution, but you've got unprocedural strike, which many lay people call illegal strike. But in terms of the law, it's either you're procedural or not procedural. If you go on an unprocedural strike, you're taking a risk. The risk is that the law does not protect you for taking an unprocedural strike. You can be dismissed for that. And to go to the labor court and fight that dismissal is very difficult, because the law does not protect unprocedural strike fair. If through an unprocedural strike, workers intimidate each other, that becomes a criminal act, because the criminal act prevents any violence and intimidation. The police should take, the Labor Relations Act does not deal with that, it's dealt with by the criminal legislation that regulates that, the intimidation and the forcing and the violence that take place during that. This act, and that was the reason that the committee, the Bofill committee, decided that they should take out the issues dealing with violence and all of those issues in terms of this bill. That they said that it's enough that the Criminal Procedural Act, if I'm calling it correctly, deals with that area.
Listen, and that is another question about the 3 and 6 months.
Can you instead of, can you reduce your questions and then raise them, and then afterwards then you can go to other questions?
Okay, that is my last question. Okay, but
I was going to say, let's give the department to respond to submissions from this other organization. After that, we can ask questions from here for the first presentation and the second presentation.
Okay, so
honorable
senators, you'll raise it when we come to question 10. Can you assist us, like I said when we started? I heard you said you're not going to respond as individual submissions, but I think for us it's important that you do that.
Okay.
Please. Every submission, you say this stakeholder raised one, and then this is our response to that, so that we are really able to also, you know, empower ourselves. Thank you. Over to you.
Just one area that we've missed out in the first slide. is the area on clause 38, which deal with high earners. In the original bill, we're proposing that people who are earning above a million should not have access, basically, to unfair dismissal provision in the CCMA, and that provision also was taken out by the committee, precisely because of constitutionality, but it's, we've missed it in the slide. Now, there are many organizations, Chair, that have raised the issue of constitutionality, that the bills are not constitutional.
Sorry, you see, on the presentation, we do have where you've done that.
Yes.
So that's why I requested that, similar to what you have done here, with the submissions that you have, you must also respond directly to this on this.
Chair, it's part of the, at the beginning, it's not doing that, but in the slides that when we reach that slide, it's going to be talking to those areas. But as I go through the slides, some of the slides are not the same as written as that. And but it, as I said, it's going to deal it. In some of the issues, it's going to deal with them exactly in terms of who said what. The issue of constitutionality, Chair, that this bill, I mean, many organizations are raising this issue of constitutionality, whether this bill is constitutional, whether the changes that we are making on the labor brokers are constitutional, and we'll be dealing with those issues. The bill has been satisfied by both the state law advisors and the parliamentary law advisors have looked at the bill. Therefore, on the constitutionality, both those institutions are happy with how we've covered the areas. We believe that the bill is consistent with the constitution in all areas. In fact, this bill is not prohibiting labor broking, but it's regulating it. Therefore, it cannot be questions on the basis of constitutionality on the issue of regulation. It's not a prohibition of labor broking. The next issue that has been raised, Madam Chair, is the impact of the bills on jobs. Many organizations talk about this. As a department, we've got to answer two things, jobs and vulnerability. We've got to try and balance those, that workers must have a job and also we must try and deal with the vulnerability of workers. And the Constitution requires that all employees are entitled to fair labor practice. Now, the practice for us, the way we see it, of labor broking undermines that fair labor practice. And that's what we're trying to deal with this bill. Employment equity prohibits, and the Constitution prohibits unfair discrimination. That's what these bills are trying to do between employers employed by labor brokers and employers employed by the client. Secondly, the constitutionality, the basis of publicly available statistics in the work done to date in terms of the current labor, the bills themselves, we concede that there's no doubt that if you're introducing new provisions, there is a risk that it might affect jobs. The same thing happened when we were introducing wages in the farming sector. When we're increasing wages from 69 to 150, there was a big issue about what effect that will have on the jobs in the farming sector. And we had to take a risk. And that's what running business is all about sometimes. You take calculated risks. And in that instance, we took calculated risks. We went for 150 when everybody was telling us that if you increased wages is going to cause job losses. And the end result, yes, there has been job losses, but they've been minimal. And we believe the same thing is going to happen here in this. And we believe that it is the responsibility of Parliament to ensure that vulnerable workers are looked after. And these proposals are dealing with that. Thirdly, Chair, the assessment of likely job losses should ideally factor in short-term and medium effect of job losses. You might, when you introduce new system now, lose some jobs, but in the long term, the economy might recover and you might regain those jobs. Therefore, you can't make a decision on the basis what short-term losses you're going to have when you make those changes. Therefore, as we say, whilst there may be job losses in the short term, we believe that there will be recovery over time, and those job losses are gonna be minimal. And the issues that we've got to deal with, that these bills are trying to deal with abuse workers, the rollover of contracts, the issue of making workers permanently temporal employees, the issue of making workers earn less because they are employed by labor brokers, their ability to take up their cases at the CCMA, all of these issues affect workers' constitutional rights, and we've got to deal with them. Therefore, we're asking members to balance the rights. The issue of constitutionality, the impact on jobs, and the vulnerability, the dealing of the vulnerability of workers. There are many members, Chair, that have submitted submission about organizational rights, where they are saying that if you are making it easy for trade unions to get organizational rights, you are creating a situation where there would be many trade unions in the labor market. Now, there's a contradiction here, Chair, on this issue. If we look on the strike in the platinum sector, the strike by AMCU early this year, it was precisely because they could not exercise their organizational rights. Now, we're making changes here to make it easy for trade unions to exercise their organizational rights. Now, the organization that says, when you do that, making it difficult for employers. We believe it's in the interest of the economy that we reduce strike as a result of organizational right. That's what the changes that we're making in Section 21, the organizational right. Now, many business organizations are saying we should not give minority union rights. Now, it's for members of the committee to decide whether that is right or wrong. What we're saying is that the practice, if you look at what has happened in the platinum sector, is precisely this, because minority union could not have access. And this bill is trying to deal with that issue. And we believe it is a fair proposal that we're putting on the table. And the submission here, in the submission, that are questioning this provision. The issue of trade unions, our constitution is based on the right of trade unions to exist. And it's our duty to make it easy for trade unions to organize workers who are working for temporal agencies, who are working on fixed-term contracts. That's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to make it easy for trade unions to get membership. And we believe it's right, it is fair. We believe that it is a legitimate balancing of power for commissioners
when they take decision on whether trade union has got representativity, they exclude temporal workers, part-time workers, because those workers are difficult to organize. They are in today, they are out tomorrow. And they should exclude contract workers in there, so that the representativity of trade union is looked at purely on the full-time staff in that company, so that we make it easy for the trade union to get membership and do its work in the different companies. The issue of equal treatment . The Constitution, our Constitution, the Constitution of the country guarantees equal treatment. Now, we're making changes that says that people who are employed by labor brokers should be treated equally with other workers. Now, there are many in the submission here who do not agree with that equal treatment. And we believe that goes against the grain of the Constitution and fairness. If you do the same job, you should be treated the same. And that's what this says. And the issue of the deeming provision that workers who are working for the client doing the same job are deemed to be, must be treated not less than favorably than other workers employed by the labor broker. It's a fair amendment that we're making in this. And the first important point, this equal provision will apply after 3 months. It's not that when you come in the company today, the provision will apply. The analysis that has been made by SB, by business, does not make decision between employees who are part-time and who may be deemed to be employee after 6 months. And secondly, that analysis that business has made, the cost-benefit relating to the wages that the employee receives, as these are calculated on a percentage basis, it's not clear. And elsewhere in the amendment, we give pointers to grounds for justifiable differences between treatment. For example, we're not saying that every worker must earn the same salary. If you got more service than me in any organization, therefore you'll earn more. If you are more skilled than me, you'll earn more, even if you're doing the same job. Therefore, there are differences in those issues. And also this analysis that business has done, we believe that must be treated very cautious in relation to assessment of equal treatment. It is worth recognizing members that equal treatment needs to be viewed in the context of our history in this country. The Constitution, as I've said, has strongly emphasized equality. Finally, we are not the only country that is introducing restriction to temporal employment. Everybody talk about China. China has done the same as a country. Workers employed by temporal employees in China must be paid the same. Korea, not North Korea, South Korea, has done the same. Therefore, we're not the only country in the same kind of development that has done this. We're following the global trend on this area. The issue of compliance.
There's a big issue about the changes that we are making on compliance with the BCA. Now, the changes, members, that we're making there is to give inspectors discretion. Presently, if you employ a domestic worker, you don't pay that domestic worker the wages that are in the sector designation. The inspector comes in to enforce the basic condition. What will take place is that the inspector must ask for an undertaking from you as an employer. The inspector can't take you to court. They must ask for an undertaking. An undertaking is nothing other than a promise. You must make a promise that says, I will comply with the law. That's what the law says. Then the next thing, that if you do not comply with that promise, the inspector must give you a compliance order that says, comply with the law. You made a promise to comply, the inspector now must give you a compliance order. Now, what we are changing here, Minister, members, is that we are saying that inspectors should be able to say, for this employer, we are not going to accept the promise, because this employer was here yesterday, this employer did not pay, is a perpetual disregard of the law. He's been here yesterday, that week, and that week, but the law says, irrespective of that, the inspector must get a promise. We say, why shouldn't the inspector get a promise first? If the inspector knows that this employer gave me a promise yesterday, but did not meet the terms of that promise, he's here again on another case, the inspector must give a promise. That's the changes that we are making around this area. And many of the submissions that are made by business are not happy with that change that we are making in this area. The next area that we are making changes on in this area, members, is the issue of appeal. Where an employer gives an undertaking, a promise, they got a compliance order. The law presently says they can object to that compliance order. After objection, they can appeal against that compliance order. We're saying that process is just too long. If we give an employer a compliance order, we should be able to go to court to enforce that without an appeal. Anybody that wants to appeal must appeal in court. If an employer gives a promise and say, I will pay, we should be able to take that promise and take it to court and say, this employer has agreed and said that I'm promising to pay, they did not pay, the court must enforce that promise. If you make a promise, it should be a promise that you keep. And those are the issues around the Basic Condition of Employment Act. And some of these issues have been agreed by organized business at NetLand, except the issues around the appeal and objections. The next area that many commenters on who submitted here are complaining about is wage increase on actuals. We're saying, members, that in the domestic sector, if the minister increases wages, the minimum, to 140, and I work for a domestic worker, I work for you, and you pay me 141, technically I'm not entitled to an increase, because I earn a rand more than what the minister has put the minimum. And we're saying that everybody is affected by inflation. Everybody else's salary is adjusted by inflation. Now you've got this worker who earns 140, who's not entitled to any increase only because she or he earns 1 rand more than the minimum. And we say the minister should be able to say, I'm increasing the minimum to 140. At the same time, I'm saying those who are earning more than 140 should at least be able to get an inflation linked increase. If inflation is 5%, the minister could say, 5%, I'm giving you 5%. Yes, you're earning more than the minimum, but the minister should be able to say, we think inflation affects you just like everybody else. And that's a big area that there's been no agreement on this bill. the issue of bargaining council extension agreements, the minister, we had the, there's a big, there are many court cases around this area. And we say to the minister that if a bargaining council does not engage, and the bargaining council assumes that the effect of an amendment will increase the size of the workforce covered by bargaining council, we're making changes that the minister, when she extends collective agreements of bargaining council, she should be able to say, I'm not going to count workers employed by labor brokers. Because remember, members, when the minister extends an agreement, she must check how many workers are represented by trade unions. We've already said that workers employed by labor brokers are difficult to organize. Trade unions can't organize them. Workers employed on a fixed-term contract are difficult to organize. Workers employed on a part-time are difficult to organize. Now, if the bargaining council reaches an agreement, the minister must extend it. If in extending that agreement, the minister must count all the workers, the chances are that the trade unions are not going to be representative. And if the trade unions are not representative, then the minister will not be able to extend the agreement. And if the minister doesn't do that, workers will stay in vulnerability. And there will be more strikes. For example, now, let us assume that in the motor, in the petrol sector industry, they reach an agreement now. They must come to the minister for the minister to extend this agreement. And the minister says, I'm not prepared to extend this agreement because your representativity is low. The effect that will have is that those workers will go out and strike again. You are not solving, you are not creating peace in the labor market. And we believe that by giving the minister that ability to make it easy for bargaining council and trade unions to get representativity and extend their agreement, you're dealing with peace in the labor market. And the issue of atypical employment in this sector, as I said, is very, very important. Business has done, as we said, an impact assessment looking at the extension of collective agreement. And they say that this is going to reduce employment by 7 to 16% in small firms when the minister extends collective agreements to them. And we say they do not explain how, no explanation is provided for this method and the original research to which it draws the summary. Their paper does not make any allowance for the fact that certain agreements have special dispensation for small business. Agreements of bargaining councils, there are two things. They've got special dispensation for small business and employers can apply for exemption. If you apply for exemption, the bargaining council, in terms of the law, is bound to listen to your case. And we do not believe that this issue about the bargaining council and its effect on jobs when they extend their collective agreement is fair. Then another issue that the comment about members is that the issue of labor tenants. In the case in KwaZulu-Natal and we think in some small areas in Mpumalanga, there's still what we call today labor tenants. These are people who work mainly in farms, who do not get paid. They get paid by having access to land. They are not employed, they are not regarded as employees. They are regarded as labor tenants. They stay there. The farmer will say, okay, you work in our farm. We will give you a piece of land to graze your stock. You'll be able to have stock. We'll give you a piece of land to graze your stock. You must have, for example, they might say you must have less than, not more than 50 cattle here. You can graze your stock, and we'll give you a piece of land you can plow it. in return, you must work in the farm. Now, there are two legislations here. There is the Land Tenure Act, which says that if you are a labor tenant, your conditions must be not less than favorable than the BCA. The BCA talks to wages. But the Land Tenure Act says that if you are a labor tenant, you are not an employee. But your condition must be not less than favorable than what is in the BCA. And we're trying to solve that problem. Now, inspectors have got a problem. How do they decide what is the cost? If this, the minimum wage is in the agriculture sector, 2,400, and you've got a piece of land, how do they decide that that piece of land is worth the same as the money that you have earned if you work? And that's the issue that we're trying to put here. We're saying that the minister should be able to value this piece of land that you've got access in against what the BCA says all workers should have. For us, we would be happy if the system of labor tenure could end, but it is by another legislation that allows it. We've got to regulate and manage this, and that's what we're trying to deal with in the issue of labor tenure. Therefore, this issue addresses a situation that exists in particular places of the country. If members will remember, there was a big issue, I think about 3 years ago, in the Midlands, in KZN, about this issue. When we introduced the sector determination, the people who are labor tenants demanded to be paid also, because they work side by side with the workers who are getting paid. But because they are labor tenants, they were not paid. And it became a very difficult issue to resolve. How do you resolve it? Because the Labor Tenant Act says they are not. Now, Cliff Decker and Hofmeyr, they are raising the issue about estate agencies, and they are asking whether estate agencies are employees or independent contract within the labor court, within this issue. They are worried that the issues about temporal employment and the issue about the fact that people are going to be treated the same would make estate agents employees. And what we're saying is that there are labor court judgments on this issue. It's not an issue at all. The labor court, I mean, the jurisprudence in terms of who's an employee in this country is well written. And it's clear that if you depend on the employer, then you're an employee. But if I run a company as a state agency, I'm selling houses, I don't report to nobody, I sell houses, and I'm independent, and the presumption doesn't apply, then there's nothing to worry about. Therefore, in our response to this, we say that the jurisprudence in terms of the law and the labor court judgment are dealing with the issue that Clark Decker of Mayor is raising in their submission. SALGA raised the issue of essential services, saying that we should increase presently, refuse collection presently are not essential. They are essential after 6 weeks of a strike. Refuse collection, if you go out on strike, there will be lead charges. The Essential Service Committee decided that if you go out on strike, you don't collect your refuse for a day. Might not affect anything. There's no life in living. But if you go to strike for more than 6 weeks, that litter is parked there, there are rodents and disease present there, it could be essential. Now, what you're saying is that SALGA should approach the Essential Service Committee. There's a committee, this is not a legal issue. If they want to change their status of essentiality, they must approach the Judicial Service Committee. They can't do it by law. Because the law set up a Judicial Service Committee, they must go and argue their case there and let that committee decide whether they agree with them. Because the committee has already taken a decision on the issue and said that you can only be in essential services in refuse collection if you go out on strike more than 6 weeks. They want to reduce that 6 weeks. That's what they want. They want to reduce that 6 weeks so that you can be essential earlier. On the issues that are raised by SASLO, some of them we agree and we're going to be dealing with in terms of the documents here. They are raising the issue of Section 158(1)(b) to raise the issues of delimitation and put into some issues from the limitation place on new review proceedings. And we making progress, remember, they are saying, let me go to the issue that they are raising so that we can be clear in terms of Now, on section 187, this is a big, big issue. This is about lockout, section 187 of the law. This is about lockout. Presently, remember members, presently, in the law there are two issues. If we have wage negotiation in a company, let us say here in Parliament, my colleagues are negotiating, they can go out on strike, or Parliament can lock them out. A lockout is a strike by the company to force workers to accept a demand. Parliament will say to workers in Parliament, we're giving you 10% increase, and we want you to close the gate. You'll only come in here if you accept 10% increase. Now, what we are changing here is you can only lock out in section 187, you can only lock out if the employee refused to accept a demand, not to compel them. The present law says the employer can lock you out if to compel you to accept the demand. And we believe that there's an anomaly in the law. It should only, if you refuse to accept it, as long as you have not refused to accept the demand, the employer can't lock you out. And that's the change. And that's why it's saying that there will be confusion on this area. This is a process that we went through and compared with other legislation in the International Labour Organization. The next area that they are raising is the area of senior managers. I've already spoken about this. They were raising the issue about senior managers, saying that we should not exclude senior managers from the CCMA. It's no more an issue, this one, because it's been removed by the National Assembly from the bill. But they are putting it also. The other issue, section 189. The bill makes changes and say that presently, the first thing is that South Africa during the economic downturn lost more than 1 million workers. And we're making a change here that says that we're making two changes first on this issue of Section 189. It's about retrenchment. That the law presently says conciliation for retrenchment must only be 60 days. You consult, after 60 days you retrench or you make the changes. And we say, no, it's not fair. Parties should be able to ask for more time. And that's what we say. Parties should be able to ask for more time, and no party should unreasonably refuse more time. We're not saying that more time must be given, but we're saying that parties should not unreasonably refuse more time on this issue. The next area that we're making changes here is about retrenchment. That workers who are earning below the threshold of the BCA, which is around about 173, if I'm not mistaken. If you earn below 173, you should be able to take your retrenchment case to the CCMA. Presently, the retrenchment case, if you take it to the CCMA can conciliate, it cannot arbitrate. You must go to the labor court. Now, many of those people, they don't have the money to get lawyers to go to the labor court, and they can't approach the court, and we say the CCMA is more user-friendly to workers than the court. Therefore, we're making the change that the court should be able to arbitrate on the cases for those workers who are below the threshold. The threshold is all those workers who are not supervisors in terms of the BCA. The next area such law is not happy with the fact that we saying that after 3 months, remember we're saying 6 months in the field, after 3 months you will be deemed to be employed by the client. This is where the labor broking comes in. I'm employed by a labor broker for 3 months. And the deal now is stands itself. After 3 months, I will be deemed to be employed by the employer, the client. And that's not what they are not happy with that provision of deeming. And they say, this is not clear, the issue of deeming. For us,
can I request that you just grab a couple? Can you sit down? Can I request that everyone here just stand up and grab so that you yes.
Not about lockout. Is a proposal that they support. This is trying to deal with an anomaly. There was a fragmental case that decided in the labor court that all of us, many of us, disagreed with, and it changed the landscape and the intention of the legislation. And this is what is about the issues of compliance and the refusal to accept the demand. That's what is changing. It's making sure that the law, as interpreted by the court, because it did not meet the intention of the legislature at that stage. Members, the next provision that by SAS law is again on the issue of equal treatment on fixed term contracts. After 3 months, they are still raising 6 months. After 3 months now, you've got to be treated equally. And they worried about this area and the limitation of fixed term contracts. It's not a legal issue. Is a social economic issue from our side that has been put in terms of the law. The last one is on the BCA that they raise, where we dealing with whether workers can be forced. Presently, you find a situation in, especially in farms, where I work in a farm in the Northern Cape, maybe in the near the border, somewhere there, and the farmer forced me to buy from the farm when it's more expensive than for me to go out and buy myself. We're making a provision that a contract of employment can never force you to buy anything from your employer unless what they are asking you to buy is a benefit to you. For example, you could, if you work for MTN, MTN could say, here you are forced to be in the MTN vicinity to have an MTN contract, not a Vodacom contract. And we will pay you for that a premium. We'll pay you, or you'll charge you far lesser than what you will get in the labor open market. It's an advantage to the employee. But you can't have in a contract of employment a provision that says I must buy from you when I can get what you're selling cheaper somewhere else. Unless it's a benefit, then you can have that. And that's this proposal. There are many people, including them, who had a problem with this clause, saying that it might prevent companies offering pension, for example, If you work for civil servants, you've got to be a member of the pension fund of the government. And that exception is accepted because there's a benefit for you, for all workers in that fund, in terms of the numbers that are coming in. That's not what this is trying to do. It's trying to, it's dealing with the issues that you're buying physically. And we made changes to that in the BCA to make sure that pension fund, provident fund, medical aid are not included in that exception. And the committee made that. That's another issue that was made. And those are the issues that, when we look at it, that we've highlighted out of the submissions that were made. Many of the submissions from BUSA, from CAPES, from other organizations dealing with are also included there, although we have not gone on point by point on them, dealing with the issues of constitutionality, the issues of how we're dealing with labor broking. And many others of this submission are raising an issue. I mean, members would remember that there's been a big outcry in the labor market on the reduction of 6 to 3 months. And many business organizations were saying Parliament has undermined a NEDLAC agreement on the 6 months. That's what the newspapers were saying. And want to explain clearly upfront that there was no such an agreement at NEDLAC. At NEDLAC, business wanted 12 months. Labor wanted a ban. The proposal for 6 months was a compromise put by government on the table. Therefore, there was no agreement at NEDLAC. This issue that people are raising, that Parliament has undermined the NEDLAC process, is not correct. Because there was, on that area, there was no agreement at NEDLAC. You had two positions from different parties. Thank you, Chair. I'll take clarification and questions.
Thank you, Honorable Khurunavat, followed by Honorable Jacobs.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, we deal with my first question already with the strikes and things. I think I've got the, but still, the issue there for me is where's the democratic right? But you explain it to me in a sense. But I still feel the individual haven't got a right. If the union decided we strike, then there's a strike, and the democratic right of a person is not really covered here in the bill for me. And and then you also mentioned we are. Let me just see what I wrote here. We are going to cover recover job losses. I can see, thank you. it's about the job losses. You said we can recover job losses, but now I want to know on the short term, if you can give us more clarification around it. I'm not understanding it very well. If you said we recover job losses in the short term, if you can explain it to me a bit more. And then also the other question, maybe they will follow up, Chairperson, but that was the 3 months and 6 months. For me, the 6 months, I will go for the 6 months from my side, because that is also about, if it's 3 months, it will cost jobs at the end of the day. And if it is 6 months, we can keep some jobs. So if you can give us a bit more clarification on that one as well, that is my feeling around that at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you.
It shows Honorable Grunewald is an employer.
He's taken side with the employer. Maybe I have to take sides with the workers. Chair, I'm not sure on this issue of labor law amendments, whether when this was reviewed, there were specific sections that they had to deal with, or it was just you just have to change overall laws that were there in the Labor Relations Act and the BCEA. Because what I want to raise is a question: when this issue of labor brokering came into place, there was this issue that we need to define who's the employer. And I don't hear it coming from the department, because I think that is the first thing that we need to know, so that we should know who is the employer. Is also the labor brokers employers? There's something which I've missed now. No, it does not need. on the issue of labor broking, the last time when I raised, when we were in Pretoria, when I asked to say, why don't we say labor brokering should become a recruitment agency? You said it's like we are banning it. Now I want to get clarity. Because if you say you ban something is not in operation. But here, if I say let them work, but they recruit employees and refer them to where they are supposed to go, does it mean we are banning? Because we are giving them, they are still doing their jobs. So yeah, I just want to get clarity on that one. This issue of temporary, casual, and so on, I'm not so sure. Sometimes you find that you say somebody is casual, is part-time, and so on. But it means there is a job somewhere there. But we want to classify it as short, as temporary, and so on. But there is work that has to be done. And now, how do we classify that one also? Because if there is job that has to be done, it means somebody has to be employed. Because I know you find that in supermarkets, in retail companies. You know, that's why you find that you have temporary workers. All the time they are there. So it means the job is always there. That's another issue that I want to know. Maybe the other one, it is this one of 6 months, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. I read in some of the submission here. They were saying after 3 months somebody must be permanent if you have employed. But we find that some companies, they employ somebody temporarily to fill the space for somebody who has gone for accouchment leave. And that accouchment leave is 4 months. But here you say if somebody has worked for 3 months, he must be permanent. And now how do you defend that one between 3 months and that 4 months? And maybe the other one that we need to strike a balance between 3 and 6 months. Maybe if we know the disadvantages of 3 months and the advantages of 3 months, the advantages and disadvantages of 6 months, so that if we have that, we can maybe try to strike the balance between that, because it's not only three, six, there is also 12 months. There are those who are still proposing that there must be 12 months. And the other one, as we have said, on the procedures, CCA and so on, where you find that some of the, these processes are cumbersome, they are very long. And they involve the leaving of a person, because a person ends from the job in which he was employed. Let's say he's dismissed, and he takes processes, just as we have indicated, somebody will challenge to say, this is not a jurisdiction to handle this case. So it means it's going to take a long process for that case to be settled. I don't know whether you had to look all those issues. That is, the process must be short. They should not take long, because they involve the lives of people. The other one that I have a concern here. Are we not giving the minister a lot of powers? Because here you always say the minister must have the right to do this. The minister has got the right to do this. The minister has got the right to do this. Are we not giving the minister? Sometimes you'll have a good minister, sometimes you have a hostile minister who will misuse his or her powers. So I'm just worried about that. We are always saying, you talked about the actual raise of the actual extensions, the labor tenants. Those were some of the issues where you say the minister must have the right to do this and that one and that one. This one of when you say, they say NEDLAC has resolved on the issue of 6 months, 3 months. Does it mean any decision that comes from NEDLAC that it's a final decision? The parliament cannot change that. I just want to check on that one also, because to me, NEDLAC should be advising us, so that when we take decision on the advice that comes from NEDLAC. So I think if you can also try to. Respond to that. I'll come to second round.
Thank you, Honorable Jacobs. Mr. Mkalip, on the issue of the regulatory, the findings of on the regulatory impact assessment, if maybe you can explain to us on the equal treatment of temporary and fixed term contractors that might lead to, don't you think that might lead to job losses? If maybe you can just, you know, clarify us on that one. And stakeholders in their submissions also made a point that the interpretation of the provisions of on labor brokers might be interpreted to mean they are banning and might be challenged. That's what they said, might be challenged in the Constitutional Court as the Constitution guarantees freedom to trade. How possible is this challenge? And will there be any monitoring system to ensure that labor inspectors do not abuse their discretion to secure written undertakings from employers for compliance, or do not take bribes so as to turn a blind eye from employers who are not complying with the provisions of the RLA? Also on the, with regard to the DLA, Cliff Decker of May's concern that the DOL Department of Labor says that the issue is dealt with in terms of jurisprudence. However, this jurisprudence has developed under the current legislation with the amendment. Will the jurisprudence not change? In other words, will their concern not still be valid? We'll come back. You know, like I said, we want to really understand this very, very clearly, Mr. Mkalupe. I think members will agree that when we next week, maybe we will meet for the whole day. We'll meet in the morning, go for lunch, and then come back. But we'll see if there's no planners, we'll have to deal with this bill very, very thoroughly, so that we also understand it when we make this when we adopt it. Then we adopt it in such a way that we are also really very satisfied. Over to you, Mr. Mkali. Honorable Jacobs?
Yeah, there's one issue that I want to raise. On the issue of retrenchments, I don't know whether this has changed or it has not changed. They say if the employer wants to retrench, you may consult with labor union and the workers. And now there was this, what is the minimum of consultation? Because sometimes the employer just write a letter to say I'm retrenching. So just by me writing that letter, he will be saying he's consulting you. I think these are things that has happened. Or just to tell you I'm going to retrench. Just by speaking to you, it means he's consulting you. Whether you have views that you want to put on the table, and you won't listen to that. But he has told you that I have consulted you because I have talked to you about this issue. The last one is that ENLO has stated that the definition of employee is problematic because the way it is drafted, it will extend to independent contractors. These are commercial contracts that should not be included according to ENLO. You can also respond to that. Thanks.
American Chamber of Commerce raises a number of questions in relation to Section 198A that needs clarity. For example, what if remuneration fluctuates? If no one performs similar work, people in permanent positions receive different pay, and if benefits reduced, take home pay. Did you get this? And also with regard to ILO, a number of submissions have dealt with the fact that the proposed amendments are not in line with the ILO provisions. The Retail Association in the ILO Convention 181 has specifically identified as labor market facilitators, and there is no international precedent that deals with the proposals in terms of part-time workers as per the amendments, and these provisions far exceed the requirements of the ILO. If maybe you can clarify what ILO says there to us, whether we are in line in this bill. Over to you, Mr. Mkalip.
Thank you, Chair and members. The issue about individual rights, the workers, the issue about by Honorable Kunewald on whether the individual rights of workers has not been taken if you do not introduce the ballot. Our take in this is that first is that workers take their individual rights by becoming members of the union in the first place.
is an association that workers decide to make. If they are not happy with the way the association works, the best way of workers doing that is to move, to vote with their feet and move out of it. Exactly what has happened in the Platinum Center, where members move from AMCU from NUM to AMCU. Yes, that's workers using their freedom of association to decide who to associate with. That's the first power that the workers have got in terms of the law that protects their individual rights. They can still use that. And still, trade unions are organizations that are controlled by individual members. If they want their constitution to provide for a ballot, nothing prevents them in going to their Congress and say, let us amend our constitution so that our constitution can say, before we go and strike in this union, let's call for a ballot. And the law says that if you've got that in your constitution, you've got to comply with it. If you don't comply with your constitution, then you're acting ultra vires in terms of the law. Therefore, we don't think that that affects the individual action of workers. And if the absence of a ballot includes intimidation and violence, what we say is that then the police must do their job in that, because that's an illegal act in terms of the Criminal Procedural Act. You don't need the LRA even to regulate that. The police should be doing what they need to do on that. And that's basically our short response on this issue, whether does it affect the individual rights of workers. What we're saying on this issue of job losses is that we use example of the farming sector. When we started the process of increasing wages in the farming sector, all employers, we went to have public hearings in all the province. They refused to put anything on the table, saying that anything that you do, there will be a bad blast in the market, in the farming sector, there will be job losses, and the whole works. If we had listened to that and not increased, the minister had listened to that and not increased the wages, the workers will still be living in vulnerability. But the minister said, yes, we accept that there might be job losses, but we must balance the two. Workers living in vulnerable vulnerability and job losses. And we said that are these job losses that might occur in the short term, are there prospect of recovering in the longer term? And that's the approach that we took in that situation. And that's what the same approach here. We can't argue that there will not be job losses. Anybody that can say that, when government introduced legislation and say, we guarantee the market that there will be no job losses, then that person must be a rich person. I mean, then if they can predict that, they can make a lot of money, even in the stock, in the Toronto Stock Exchange. Nobody can predict that there will not be job losses. But for us, the issue is how extensive are those job losses. And we're saying that in the short term, there might be job losses, minimum job losses, but we believe that there will be recovery in the long term, in the long term. And that's what we're saying between the short term and the long term. And we're not able to say there will be no job losses at all. Even what business is saying, that there will be job losses. Our own research that we did indicate that there might be job losses when we introduced regulation. We knew that because we did an impact study on the bills. And it says that there will be job losses. But then it says government has got two possibilities here. Government has got the workers that we want, the issues that we want to correct are real. The socio-economic position that workers are in are real. The problem that labor brokers bring in the labor market is not the bottom of our imagination. It's real. And that research said that when we do the right thing, we will be able to positively affect socio-economic condition of workers. And we have to balance that. Therefore, what we're saying is that, yes, we think in the short term there might be job losses. But we think that in the longer term,
those job losses will be offset and there will be changes. And the same thing, I'm using the example of the farming sector, the same, and I'm saying, not saying that the threat of job losses is not real, but as I'm saying is that if we are going to be saying that if people cry wolves, and then we'll say we are not going to do anything because of that, that's also an application of our responsibility. And that's the issue that we're raising on issue of job losses.
Sorry, Chief. Can I just follow up on the same issue?
Please, if you don't mind. I'm coming from the Northwest province, and that is where all the trouble in the mines is, especially in Rustenburg. Now, regarding these strikes, the demand is high. And now the mindset, they are going to delay 14,000 people at the stage. But actually, it is better now at this very moment. Now it's about 2,000-3,000 people. It is still a lot of people. And that is what my worry is around these short-term jobs. These people who is losing their jobs now is forever. And what are we going to do about that?
Next week, you can put that one aside, pack it,
okay.
And then you will respond to him after you've given it a thorough,
The next area, I mean, is what are the benefits of the 6 months, the 3 months, the 12 months? There's no doubt that if you're moving from the premise that the more stricter the arrangement, the more job losses you would have if that move from the premises. Therefore, it goes without saying that if you could argue that if you put 12 months, you'll have lesser job losses. If you put 6 months, if you put 3 months, and you could make that argument that the more months you have, the lesser jobs you lose. I mean, that there's no scientific research that has been done by business, by labor, and by government that says what would be the effect of 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. Therefore, I'm not in a position, I won't be even the next week to be in a position to say, well, these are the benefits. What we know the benefit of 3 months is that workers employed by labor brokers will be able to get out of vulnerability quicker for 3 months, then 6 months. They will be able to earn equal pay quicker. Therefore, it's going to affect their ability, their increase, their living standard, those workers. And that's the benefit to workers on that. The issue of definition of who's an employee, I mean, there was, I understand the honorable member, right? Employer, yes. The issue of defining employer. There was that talk before, I remember when the Portfolio Committee on Labour went on public hearings two years ago, all over the country, on this issue. They came up with this notion that if you define an employer, you might be dealing away with the issue of labour broking. When we look at this issue legally, we all agree, between labor, business, all of us agree that the definition of an employer is not necessary. The law presently does not define an employer. Because when you start defining an employer, there's a danger that many employees will lose their right on the basis that their employer is not an employer. When you do that, that's the danger that you're going to have. And since 1995, I mean, even not 1996, since when the first Labor Relations Act came into this country, there's never been a definition of an employer, precisely for that danger, that defining an employer is more dangerous because an employer changes. And when you define an employer and then an employee falls outside that definition, those employees then, if you say this is not an employer, whatever definition that you put on, you are putting workers at risk. Business agreed on this, labor agreed on this, and we all agree that it's not good practice. Nowhere internationally is there a definition of an employer. You never define an employer. But you do define an employee. That's what our legislation is doing. And that's the reason that we did not define an employer. And the next area is that that argument about defining an employer was linked to this issue whether should they be allowed to be an employer or should they only place. As soon as you say in law you are not allowed to do this work, those guys in that corner will say you are interfering with my right to trade. But when you say, if you say you cannot employ but you can only place, the constitutional provision comes in because you're saying them, they cannot do their trade, whatever trade it is. And that's the problem that comes out with restricting them to certain functions. It's one thing when you say you can employ people under these terms for this period. You're not interfering with their right to trade. They can trade as much as they want to trade, but you can only employ people on temporary employment for 3 months. And that's the difference in this issue. When you start telling them what trade they can do, when you say you can't be an employer, it comes into that. Even if you say you can only place, what they will say, well, we want to do more, we want to grow our business. We don't want only to place. Would want to do other things, want to be an employer, do other things. And when you restrict them in that, that's where the constitutional challenge will come. And that's the reason that we did not go that route. Precisely because even the International Labour Organization, it will be against the same convention that we are talking about in terms of the ILO. When you say to employers, they can't do certain things. And that's why the advice that we received from our lawyers and the discussion is that if you go that route, there's a guarantee that the Constitutional Court will regard that provision as being unconstitutional. And that's the only reason that we did not go that route, of confining them to placement only. The issue of part-time work and temporary work, well, these are two different concepts. Temporary work is temporary work where you work temporarily, but not part-time. You work for 5 days as a temporary employee. You are employed in temporary employment. Part-time work, as you said, is mainly in the retail where you work part-time. And sometimes part-time is beneficial. It's workers themselves who want to work part-time. You might have an employee that is starting a family that says, I can't work 5 days a week. I want to work 2 days a week. If the employer agrees, that's what part-time work is. In the retail, you've got people that are working part-time work. They'll work for 2 days a week, 3 days a week, depending on the demand in the retail. In the retail, if it's seasonal, they'll bring more people to work at part-time work. The only thing that we're doing here is to build in protection for those workers, that they should be treated not less favorable than anybody else. If the hourly rate is 20 rand, they should be able to earn the same as everybody. Yes, they will take less home because they work less hours. But under normal circumstances, when you look at the bigger picture, they'll be earning the same, but taking less home because they work less hours. And the treatment will be the same. That's the protection that we're trying to build around part-time work. Temporary work is our attempt to deal with the issue of caste and labor broking. That's the temporary work. Therefore, these are two concepts which are different on part-time and temporary work and the issues that we want to do on them. And the issue of temporary work and part-time work for employers who want people to work for 3 months, for example, as you were saying, that if you are on maternity leave, you take 4 months maternity leave. Now the employer wants to replace you for that 4 months. Yes. Replace you for that 4 months. What happens now? That's a question that honourable member is asking. The bill is saying 3 months, and the employer wants somebody for 4 months. In the bill, the exceptions, there are about 20 exceptions where you can work on a fixed-term contract for more than 3 months. One of them is if you're replacing somebody because the person has been booked off by a doctor. It could not be even maternity leave. It could be I'm booked off because I've got TB. The doctor booked me off for 6 months. I'm confined into a hospital for 6 months. And the employer wants to replace me for that 6 months. In terms of the bill that is in front of you members, you can do that. The law allows you to do that because it's an exception. Therefore, that issue that you're raising, member, is covered around the areas of exception. For example, if government want to build another World Cup stadium, let's say we win another bid from FIFA, want to build another stadium, or want to build Medupi, and you win a tender from government, and the tender says that you must build the stadium within 10 years. The law does not say that when you employ workers, you must employ them full-time. Because you've got a contract for 10 years, you can still employ them for fixed-term contract for more than 3 months. Because it's an exception, it's one of those exceptions where you can show that this is a project that you've been entered into. It's going to last for 5 years. The only difference is that if then that's the case, when that project ends, those employees must be paid retrenchment pay. Presently, if you're employed on fixed-term contract and your contract ends, there's no retrenchment pay presently because you were on fixed-term contract. Now, we're changing the law in that. We say you should be entitled to retrenchment pay even if you're on fixed-term contract. The reason we're allowing the exception, we're saying workers, this is an exception. You work for 5 years on fixed-term contract, yes, but at the end of that contract, you'll be paid 1 week for every completed of service and a compensation for being fixed-term contract. Therefore, what I'm saying, there are exceptions in the law. It's not that every situation is 3 months. There are about 20 exceptions that are in section 198A, capital A. Mm-hmm. It's got all those exceptions. The powers of the minister. Presently, the minister has got authority to set up sector designation. Any minister, unless you change the constitution, any minister that abuses power or anybody can take that minister to court. Any minister that abuses power. This is not about abuses power. This is not about giving minister more power. It says that presently the minister can introduce sector designation, but the minister can only increase minimum. The minister can't increase, for example, an inflation-related increase for people who are earning above the minimum. And we're giving her the authority in terms of the law to be able to do that. When she increases wages, she can increase the actual wages. And if she abuses her power, I'm definitely sure business will be the first one in court to challenge her in that. Because this does not mean that, does not give her power to abuse, but it gives her authority to be able to take decisions. And we believe that the constitution and the laws in this country are strong enough to prevent any minister to abuse their power. Can NEDLAC, what's this NEDLAC and what's the relationship between NEDLAC and Parliament? Parliament is the highest authority in this country in terms of our constitution. Parliament can decide on anything, and make that decision.
But common sense tells us that if Parliament is going to introduce a law in the labor market, it makes sense for Parliament to listen to those that operate in that arena. But doesn't take away the right of Parliament to decide on anything, because that's what our constitution says. Therefore, Parliament can change the Metlag agreement. If parties agree on A and Parliament says, yes, we agree, it's just like the same as public hearings. You go out and have public hearing and public comments, it does not necessarily mean that Parliament must accept everything that has been said. They must consider it and apply their mind as members and take a decision. The same applies with NEDLAC. But what we're arguing and what NEDLAC constituents will argue that it makes sense for Parliament to pass laws that are acceptable, something that is acceptable by the constituencies that use it. It's far easier when you put laws that are acceptable by the citizens than put laws that the citizen might revolt against. That's the only issue. Yes, the NEDLAC Act says that before laws come into Parliament that affect the labor market should have been debated at NEDLAC. And that NEDLAC Act was passed by Parliament. It's Parliament who said that. Therefore, one would expect that Parliament will respect the legislation that they are putting in place. But it does not say that NEDLAC is about Parliament. Parliament still retain this authority to make decisions on behalf of the country. Therefore, that argument that some people, obviously there will be people that for their interest will argue that when it is something that they support, Parliament should never change. You'll have those. When it's something that they do not support, they will urge you to ignore NEDLAC. And you'll have those arguments, different arguments. But it doesn't take away the right of Parliament to take decisions on these issues. The issue of RIA and the impact on jobs, we've discussed this issue a long time. The constitutionality of 6 months or 3 months for that matter. Our argument that there's nothing unconstitutional in this in the provision that is in the law. That's what the state law advisors are saying to us. That's what parliamentary law advisors are saying to us, because the provision as they stand, they do not prevent employers to do anything other than saying that when you employ, after this period, you'll be deemed, the employees will be deemed to be employed permanently. It's not changing their right to trade. It's not interfering with anything. Therefore, there's no constitutionality in this at all. But we can't guarantee that there will be no person that challenges it. That's the right of the citizen to go to the constitutional court. It will be our right to go and defend this provision in the constitutional court. And we're confident of our chances of winning it in the constitutional court. The issue of monitoring of labor inspectors not to abuse the discretion. In fact, members, our advice to our inspectors is this. We say, inspectors, in all instances, you must try and get a promise. In all instances, you must try. Because it's better when you've got a promise from employer. If an employer promises you to pay, if let's say I've not been paying my wages, and the employer says, no, I agree, I've erred in this case, I promise to pay this employee next Friday. If that employer does not implement that promise, then the inspector can take that promise, remember that promise is in writing, go to court and say, Your Honor, this employer was in our office, this is the promise that they've made. In terms of the changes that we're making now, the inspector can take that promise and go to court with that promise and say the court must enforce that promise. Therefore, it's easier to enforce a promise. A promise is an agreement. Undertaking is an agreement. If you enter into an agreement, courts in this country don't respect anybody who does not meet the terms of an agreement. You have a very difficult time to convince the court why you should not meet the terms of your promise. Therefore, it's easier for inspector to enforce the law when they've got the promise. Therefore, there's no reason for inspector to abuse this area. It will be only on exceptions where inspectors don't take a promise. It will be exception, and we say under normal circumstances they should strive to get an undertaking because it's going to be easy to enforce. It's just like an agreement. Therefore, we don't see an abuse in this area. On the issue of corruption of inspector, it's a different issue. It's going to be difficult. You're not going to have a law, foolproof law, that prevent corruption. What is important is, what do we do when an inspector is caught for corruption? That will tell others not to go that route. The action that the department will take to make sure, yes, training, yes, education, all of those issues, and ultimately then is the action that we take. The issue of Clive Decker, whether the jurisprudence is still not valid. Well, remember, jurisprudence changes with time. As condition changes, as practice changes, you'll have changes in jurisprudence in the law, as the law changes. Now that we've made changes in the law, we'll sit and wait and see how the court will interpret and create new jurisprudence. And that's what happens. The Constitutional Court has created a jurisprudence now in the education field, where they say the department is the last arbiter on admission in school. That's a jurisprudence that has been created. It was not there. In this case, we can't guarantee that the jurisprudence is not going to change. Because we've changed the law, it might also change as we go forward, depending on the arguments and the facts that we're putting in front of the court. The issue of consultation. The law says parties must consult, must have meaningful consultation. And it says on retrenchment. And it says that, and then also this is a very important issue because the law differentiates. Not talking about negotiation. You don't have to have an agreement with the workers. Business will revolt on that. Section 189 does not require an agreement and negotiation. It requires consultation. Precisely because we've got to balance two issues here. If you make it difficult for companies to retrench, if a company wants to retrench 1,000 workers, you're making it difficult. You might end up losing 10,000 because the company now goes under. And that's the balance that you need to. You need to protect workers against easy retrenchment. At the same time, you should not make it difficult for employers to retrench. If employers believe that if they put money in an investment, that they are not going to be able to take decision to reduce their number of workers, they are not going to invest. Therefore, the law is balancing that fact. It's a difficult area, this, of retrenchment. That is why it does not talk about negotiation, it talks about consultation. But even in that consultation, it says you must consult in order to reach, minimize retrenchment, select, decide who to select. It tells you the issues that you need to consult on. But it's not negotiation. You don't have to have an agreement, basically. It's consultation. Precisely because you don't want to save 1,000 workers ending up losing 10,000 because you've delayed retrenchment for too long a period. And those are the balancing act that we're trying to make. It's not for workers. The workers will say it's not entirely fair situation. They would want to prevent retrenchment altogether. But as government, we are aware of the effect that will have in the company if that happens, and it might affect all of them. And that's why the issue of consultation, not a negotiation on the issue. But the law does indicate what the consultation should try to do. the issue of whether the amendments meet the requirement of the ILO, on part time, that we're going far beyond the ILO provision on part time, we do not believe that. The ILO recognized part time work. In fact, business did not want any regulation around this, especially retail associations. They didn't want any regulation around this area. Because presently, what you find out is that you find people working in the retail on part time basis who are really treated badly. They work for 2 days, they earn far lower than their counterparts who work for 5 days. And the ILO recognized this. The ILO in the convention, it does say that workers working for part time should not be treated less favorably. Part time should be a tool because you need more workers during that time. It could be Saturday and Sunday, for example. You need more workers. You don't need more workers from Monday to Thursday, but you need more workers Saturday, Sunday, and Sunday. You should be able to get those workers. That's what part-time is there. Part-time is not a tool to exploit workers. It's a tool for flexibility, for employer to be flexible depending on the demand. Now employers are saying, when you say they must be treated the same as other workers, you are interfering. We're not interfering with that right. We're saying you treat them the same. Yes, they'll take less home because they work less 3 days. But they should have all the other benefits that the workers are having, but at a smaller scale because they work lesser hours. And that's what the convention also says. We do not think that there's anything wrong with that. But employers want to have a situation where if they employ me for 3 days, they should be able to exploit me more than the working of 3 days. If the hourly rate is 100 rand a month, they want to be able to pay me 50 rand a month and not take an hour. If the hourly rate is 100 rand, they want to be able to pay me 50 rand. And you say, that's not the reason for part-time work. Part-time work is about flexibility. It's not about how do I reduce my wage bill and get rid of workers and ask them to work part-time work. It's to be able to get workers when the demand is high. And we believe that we are within the convention. There's nothing that contravenes this convention here. I think that was the last one in terms of the question, on the issues. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. The last one. Another one.
Thank you, Chairperson. It is only, I just want to get back about the recovery of job losses, because that worried me a lot. And really, I feel at this stage, maybe I'm a bit off the point now, but the unions at this stage have got too much power when we sit around the table and negotiate. We can look into education, what happened into education. It is falling apart because of the unions. The whole education system is going down. Madupi, what happened there, the unions get into the premises and they... on the premises, they talk to the workers, and they get everything. They bring everything to a standstill there, and that is not fair. What happened in Marikana? What happened in the platinum industry? They get rid of the people because of the high demands from the union side, and that is what worried me. Now they close down shafts. And thousands of people get out of jobs, and they will never retain their jobs again. What happened to that people now? Where are the unions now? Now they sit back, and now they fight with each other. And I feel really, we must come to a point in South Africa, and you've said it now, Parliament have the authority and the power to do anything. And it is high time, and this bill must help us. so that we can put the unions in position. And we must look into the economic of the world. It is in a bad stage. And the demand is high. 14, 15, 20% increases. We can't afford it. South Africa can't afford it. And the unions sit behind it and they say, but we want it. And at the end of the day, we have job losses. We can't afford it. And I want answers. And this bill must help us to get South Africa on track again. And I, if I'm listening to you and all the comments and things, I do not think we are at this very stage at the resolution. I'm worried about it. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair. I think there's one issue that that was not responded to on the processes. On the processes, legal processes towards disputes in the labor field. That is, they take too long to be finalized. And just to make a follow-up on that one, whereby the reviewer of cases, where you said there must be a guarantor of 2 years and so on. Now, what happens if we have companies who've got money, let's say you want money for 2 years, I'll put that guarantee, money for 2 years, just to frustrate this person. Have we looked into that, and how can that be circumvented? And the other one, this issue of minority unions and minority rights, which are those rights? Because in some of the inputs here, they say if we give more rights to minority unions, there's going to be labor instability. Which are those rights? Can you just enlighten us about those rights? Because in some of these submissions, they are complaining about that. Thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry, the other one, it is the issue of equal payments for part-time and so on. Can we also be clarified on that one, especially on the side of business, because they are not comfortable to pay part-time workers the money which is the same with those who are permanent. But in any places of work, there is always a minimum, whether you have skills or you don't have skills. But when you start doing a job in that particular company, there's a minimum wage. So now why do they say if somebody is a part-time cannot get that minimum wage?
Thank you. The other one is on the retail sector determination that caters for a premium to be paid to part-time workers. What will happen to that premium? Because you mentioned that the abuse of part-time workers in the retail industry is. So what will happen to the premium? Thanks.
The
answer for the question that I raised on 198A subsection 5. I don't recall you answering that.
I'll just check it now.
Okay.
The comment by Honorable Kunewald really. The intention of this bill is not to take out the power of workers. The right of workers to strike, a constitutional right. I mean, it's a bigger debate. If you take away the freedom of workers to do what the Constitution provides, that's not the intention of this legislation. I take that as a comment. I'm not going to be able really to answer on that one. The issue of minority rights, what are these rights? It's the rights for shop steward, deductions of stop order, those kind of rights, access to the workplace, your minority union, what rights do you have, whether should you have access to your members, and should you be able to represent your members. Those are the rights that the law gives in terms of this section. Those are the rights that the employers don't want to give. They say that you are introducing workers join the union because you are a minority union, then the company should not deduct wages with submission, you should not have access, you should not have shop steward rights, your members should not be represented. Those are the kind of rights that we're talking about, this section 14, 15 rights in terms of the LRA. Those are the rights that we're talking about. The issue of security and the length it takes, we agree that presently the labor court, the process of resolving dispute is a long process. In fact, we wanted the bill, the original bill, had a situation where there was a time frame from the court to give their decision. Say, we said an employer must within 6 months, put the papers, the case must be heard within 6 months, and the court must issue the award. And then our colleagues in the justice said, no, you can't tell the court. As soon as you do that, you are interfering in the separation of powers. The courts are independent, judiciary is independent. You don't want the executive telling the court when to issue the judgment. And if you look at the bill now, it says as soon as possible. Doesn't have time, when is it? Precisely because you don't want to interfere with the judiciary. Now, we put a provision of the security because presently that employers do two things. They apply for a review of the decision of the CCMA. They apply the review in order to prevent the employee going back to work if he's reinstated or giving the money. And we're saying two things. That if you're going to apply, if the CCMA decide that I must be paid 100,000 for my dismissal, but I must not be taken back, and the employer want to challenge that, they must put that 100,000 as security. The reason we're doing that, we believe most of these review application to the labor court are an attempt to avoid to pay the money. Now, if you ask them to put that money as security, then you're taking away the incentive to prevent to pay the money. You're taking that incentive. That's the intention. Some of these reviews are to prevent you going to work so that you can earn the salary. Then we say, if the CCMA says you must be reinstated, and the employer want to challenge that, they must put security for 24 months into the court system. The employee can go to court if nothing's happening, the case is not happening, and say, Your Honor, this case has been in the books, nothing is happening, we think that the court should pay us the money. Therefore, so that the workers can start earning the money that is put in a security. That's the intention of this. We're trying to interfere exactly with the issue that the honorable member is raising. These cases that are taking a long time. We believe that when employers put the security, it's going to speed up the processes. And that's what we're thinking. We hope it will work with what we're proposing. And that's the reason that we're putting that security, that you must put the security.
On that security, money for security, let me say after 2 years, they said they have to give me that 100,000. I'm going to get it with interest, or it's just that 100,000.
The law does not talk about that, but I'm assuming that if you put money into the hands of the state, it will generate interest, but it's not going to be the same interest that we got get maybe in a fixed deposit or higher interest. But I'm sure it will generate interest if you put money into the state, and that's an admin process that might happen in terms of that process. If it does generate interest, it is going to be unfair for the state to keep the interest for it, because that money is not for the employer. It happens both ways. Also, the employer might say that if I put security, I put it there, it generates interest, and the employee loses the case. When I get my 100 rand back, do I get it with interest? The law doesn't take with those issues, but I'm saying that at the administration, if there is interest that is generated or you put it, it can't be the state's interest. It will be the interest for whoever is the money is due to, if there is interest. But people who work in this field, they normally say, sometimes they say that the money is put in a trust sometimes into, it could be, I don't know, something like a guidance fund, whatever it is, that work in this field. And I say that if there is interest, definitely it will be due to whoever the money is due to. If it's the worker will have to get it.
The stakeholders have said that the amount of security required is limiting access to court and forcing employers to accept wrong decisions. What is your take on that?
We agree, honourable member, that the intention is to limit access to court, but what members should be looking at is that when you don't do that limit, that poor worker, when you look on the record, I think about 99% of cases going to court is by employers. Now, our responsibility is to try and protect those that are vulnerable. Yes, we're saying to the rich, if you want to access court on this issue, put the money. And the intention, yes, is to restrict them to going to court on that issue. Remember, the law as it stands now, it says decision of the CCMA are final and binding. We want them to be real final and binding. But because of the challenges in the labor court, those decisions are not final and binding. We want to make them final and binding. And we think it's a fair restriction. We think it's a fair restriction restricting that, because we believe that the law should look after the social economic interests of those that are poor. Workers do not have the money. Forget about workers who are in unions, which is about only 20%. Talk about workers who are not even in unions, who don't have anybody to represent them. When their case are taken to court, the problems that they are having. And we agree. We believe this is a fair a restriction to courts. Yes, it is a restriction, because we say before you go to court, you put security. And it's not the only area. There are other areas of the law where you put security. It's not the only area that we introduce things. It's not a new process in terms of our jurisprudence. Therefore, it can be argued that it's constitutional. On the issue of equal pay for work of equal work, and the issue of employee to be treated on the whole not less favorable. Now, the on the whole less favorable, and the issue of the sector determination. Remember, the sector determination deals only with wages. It gives you premium on wages because on an hourly rate, because you are on part-time. When we talk about whole and not less favorable, we're not only talking wages. We're talking provident fund. We're talking all other benefits. If there's a provident fund in this company, you can't say because I'm part-time, I should not be entitled to a provident fund. And those are the issues that we're talking about. If the wages are better off, it's not going to be affected by this law. But what I'm saying is that whole and it must be treated equally as a whole. It does not only talk to what you take home as wages. It talks to benefits also. It talks to if there's a study, bursary fund in this company, if there's a provident fund in this company. There's no reason that people who are on part-time, who are working 3 days a week, but they work the whole year, but 3 days a week, they should not be members of the Provident Fund. If they are not members of the Provident Fund, then they must get the payment for that. They can go out and buy an RA from Old Mutual or Sanlam. But on the whole, their package should not be less than favorable. Obviously, what they get will be proportional to the amount of time that they spend in the company. But on the whole, it should be the same, including wages. Therefore, we don't think that there's a contradiction. And in any event, when a law is passed, if there's a sector designation that contravenes the law, the sector designation must be in line with the law. Because a sector designation is not a law, it's a secondary legislation. It can't, unless the legislation allows it to do that, it can't be in contravention with the law. The issue of equal pay for part-time workers, I've just dealt with it, and also the issue of what will happen to part-time workers in terms of this in relation to the sector designation, I've dealt with that.
Honorable members. okay.
Chair.
Yeah, we want clarity. When we deal with this, we are clear.
Yeah.
We are clear on what we are dealing with. Chair, I just want to check on this issue of making CCMA decisions final. Does this not give labor forums more rights than any other court? Because I want to check what is the difference to review the decision and also taking that decision to a higher court. Because it can still be the same as the reviewer of the decision. Because they can take that to a higher court and it will also drag for some time. Whilst we are trying to circumvent this to say the decision of the CCM is final. Are we not harping on the same issue to say you are trying to stop this but we are opening another channel?
Well, the issue, members, is that presently the CCMA cases can only be reviewed in a labor court. That's the first thing. Therefore, you can't review CCMA cases in the high court. It's only the labor court that has got jurisdiction. You will go to the high court on a different case. But if you review a CCMA decision, it's a labor court issue. That's the first thing. Secondly, is that presently the law says decision of the CCMA final and binding. That's what the law says. We're not making changes in that. But what we're doing is that we're strengthening that final and binding of the law by making it a little bit difficult for people to not treat decision of the labor of the CCMA as final and binding. Therefore, we're not introducing anything new. That's what Parliament passed. It stands the test of time since 1995, that is final and binding. But then the practice has been that many cases are taken on review. The intention of the legislature, when we sat down, we said the legislature had an intention that few cases of the CCMA will be challenge on review, not the number that is we're facing now. When the law was introduced, the intention was that it will be exceptions that you go through. And that's what we're trying to do. We're saying that if it's a serious case, remember in the law, there is also a provision where you can go to court and say to the court that we're asking the court to waive the security because you need to convince the court first. You convince the court that this is a very important case, constitutional. I'm assuming that in the Sedumo case, the old case, if it had happened with the security, you could go to court and argue because of the importance of the case and the jurisprudence is going to set, you could ask the court to waive a security. And you could do that. Presently, the proposal that we're making, it does allow anybody to go to court and ask the court to be able to waive the security. But you've got to show the court why it must do that. It can't be as a normal, exceptional case, that's the first thing. And then secondly, as I said, that on security, our intention is to discourage parties to challenge the same decision. And if you lose it in court and you feel so strong about this case, it's not even an issue to put your 24-month salary on the table if you feel strongly that an injustice has been committed by the CCMA, then you should be able to put the man on the table and go and fight it. It doesn't say that you should not go to court, but it's making a little bit, it's adding another hurdle in going there, because the notion of the LRA members is that labor disputes should be resolved speedily. That's what the LRA talk about. It's in the interest of business, it's in the interest of workers, it's in the interest of the economy. That labor dispute, there should be a finality easily, quickly. Now, the tendency of applying for review on each and every case undermines that. And that's the reason that we want to restrict that. If this security restricts that, we believe that it will take us back to what you as legislature intended. You intended that dispute must be resolved quickly, and we want to go back to that intention of the legislature.
Chair, I think the issue of warrant of execution is something which is new. Maybe you can respond to that. And the second one, can the employer won't take you to the constitutional court to say you have denied them the right to review the case? Because it was there. And now you are saying, no, you can't review this because it was there earlier. So won't they test it in the constitutional court to say, no, they have denied us that right to review the case?
There's no guarantee that they wouldn't test the right. The issue is, are we confident that we can put an acceptable argument in front of the court? And we are. We can't stop anybody challenging any section of this law. And there will be challenges. This law presently says that at the CCMA, lawyers are not automatically allowed in, unless in arbitration, unless, and in conciliation, unless the commissioner allows it in certain cases. It's a restriction on the right of lawyers. The lawyers have taken this, they've been threatening over the years to take that provision to court. And they ultimately done that. They took that provision to court now, into the Supreme Court. Guess what? They lost. The court, the judge said, it is fair to say that lawyers should not be allowed the CCMA. There's nothing wrong with that. Therefore, honorable members, we might be challenged, but we are confident that we can amount and present argument in front of the court that says, yes, it is a restriction, but it's a fair. That's a test in the Constitutional Court. Any provision of the Constitution can be limited. Any. The test is that a fair limitation? And we believe it is. And we will be able to show the court why we believe that it is a fair limitation. Therefore, for us, we're not worried. We think that members should believe in us that we'll put in a fight in the constitutional court to sustain this. The issue of risk, We're making it easy for CCMA. Presently, the CCMA wants, if there's a decision of the CCMA and the employer does not comply with this decision of the CCMA, they must go first to the labor court to certify that decision as if it's a decision of the labor court. That's the only thing that we do. We say, no, you don't have to do that. As you make your decision, it is as if you don't have to go to the labor court to make them. And that's a law present. That's what we are changing. And all parties have agreed to this. It will speed up the implementation of, and also for the sheriff to implement decision of the CCMA.
I think we have come to the end of our meeting for today. I see, that's why Mr. Mkalipi's head is so white, you know. He works very hard. But let me thank honorable members and thank the department for actually clarifying us on issues, even on submissions that were made. We're still going to go on, deal with some other issues next week. Bruce has been with us from last week, even today they are still here. We also thank you for that. And I think the media is also here. But let me thank everyone who seemed to have an interest in this piece of legislation. This will actually assist the people of South Africa in the future. I thank you all, and the meeting stands adjourned. Until next week, on the 9th.
Like I said, maybe we'll work for the whole day. We meet in the morning.